your fans in the United States are legion, so it's certainly a pleasure to have you here. When did you get in?
Let me see, Monday morning, I came over in Concord. Great disappointment. Elizabeth Taylor was supposed to be on the plane, and the baggage was there, and then at the last minute they took the baggage off, and she changed to the evening Concord. So we'll miss the pleasure of having her on the flight. I would have probably had advanced knowledge of Elizabeth Taylor's passion, I suppose.
Yes, we all got a whiff of it here in New York a day or two after that flight.
Yeah.
I understand that she had called a news conference to make a major announcement. We all thought she was going to announce either a wedding or a divorce, but it didn't happen that way. It's too bad.
Well, we've had weeks of it in the English media about her and George and suppositions and questions and things, you know. They've certainly spent enough time together, but there you are.
Well, it's wonderful. Right out of the pages of People magazine, isn't it?
Yeah, perfect, yes.
Well, we can talk rather casually because I take the taped interview. The tape is rolling now, but I take it and I edit it and make it very tight and neat. So it's we can just relax and chat. You have developed a huge following in the United States with your novels, and I see in some of the publicity material that although the your credits list perhaps a dozen or so, you have turned out some 50 novels, actually, and under another name, your original name. Is that correct?
I've had published over the years, actually published, 48.
Say again?
48.
48.
Published. I would estimate, I was trying to work this one out recently, and I think it's 53, if you count when I started writing as a young guy and writing stuff which didn't get published and that kind of thing, you know, years and years and years ago. So that's about 53, as I say, including a few that were never published. And then on top of that, especially in the early days when I was trying any kind of writing to break in, I wrote lots of short stories. Because everybody makes that mistake. They always think, well, if I write a short story, you know, and the implication is that it's easier. Whereas it isn't, really. I mean, there's a special technique to short story writing, and I mean, you may be a good novelist, and you may be a lousy short story writer, and of course, it applies the other way as well. I know people who write excellent short stories, but they're just incapable of writing a long book. So it's always a mistake for would-be writers to start that way. I also tried radio plays, television, and that kind of thing, all with a conspicuous lack of success, actually.
Well, let's go back and work our way up to Night of the Fox. You were born in Ireland, weren't you?
I wasn't actually born in Ireland. This is people often assume this because the circumstances were slightly unusual. I was born in England, but my parents broke up when I was literally a baby in arms. So my mother went back to Belfast, to her family, and so I was raised there. All her family were Ulster people, you see. And that's what leads to the confusion. People assume that I must have been born there because I was there from literally a few months old, you see.
So you grew up in Ulster?
That's right, yes.
What was it like in those days?
Well, it wasn't quite as bad as it is now. I mean, things are calmer now. I mean, you probably only get one policeman shot a week or one soldier shot a week or something like that now. It's not like the really bad days of the 1970s. It's a bit more like it was in my childhood. Occasional bombs, occasional shootings, a lot of religious antagonism. So that if you were a kid in the city, it was unlikely that you were in a school where you would meet people from the other side of the trench, as it were, you know, were Catholic or Protestant. And I don't mean by that necessarily the Catholics were all at church schools. You see, the system simply was that people kept to their own turf because that people lived in ghetto areas. There were Protestant ghetto areas and there were Catholic ghetto areas. So naturally the state schools in those areas only handled children who lived in the immediate area, which meant if it was a Catholic ghetto, all the kids at that school were Catholics.
Which ghetto was yours?
Well, mine was Protestant for a while, because I was actually a Protestant. But what happened was my mother used to go away to England to work. Things were difficult in those days, and she had to go wherever she could get work to support us. And I lived with my grandmother for a while, but she was in extremely poor circumstances. And so I went to live with a Catholic auntie in a very rural area, a woman who had a small farm, a widow. And this was near a place called Cross Maglen, which is the most notoriously Catholic Republican area in the whole of Ireland, never mind Northern Ireland. It's a place which is so dangerous even now that when British troops RUC police are moving in that area, they move by helicopter. They don't move by road because it's so dangerous. More soldiers have been killed in that one area than any other part of Ulster. And I lived there for years as a kid. And I was a Protestant boy, but my auntie was a Catholic, you see. And everybody knew that. And they treated me fine. I mean, I was no threat. I must have been the only Protestant for miles, you know. She used to take me to Mass and all that kind of thing. I suppose she worried about my soul. But it made me schizophrenic because I loved her a great deal. And then when I went back to Belfast and saw, say, my grandmother, who was Protestant, I loved her. But they both used to rubbish each other. They'd go on about each other, this religious thing. And that was very schizophrenic for me as a growing boy because I loved them both, so I couldn't understand why all this religious thing was so important. And it did mark me very much in later life, because the funny thing was, my mother remarried. I suppose I was about, I don't know, 12 or something like that, and we went to live in Yorkshire in the north of England, which is a very special part of England. It's a kind of Texas, you know. The people really think they're different from everybody else in England, and they're very plain spoken and tough and rough, and they speak in an inimitable way, and so on. And I went to this place to live, and the funny thing was that there was a very high proportion of Jewish people living in that city. There was a lot of garment manufacturing, and it probably had the highest proportion of Jewish people in England. And in those days, not now, but in those days, there was quite a lot of anti-Semitism. I don't mean of a really bad kind. I don't mean you had mobs walking in the street, but people would say things, you understand what I mean. And I fell straight into the same problem I'd had in Ireland. The first day I was sort of standing in line in the school, there was this great big kid next to me with a broken nose, a great big craggy kid, you know, and dark curly hair, who looked like a young Irish navvy on a bad night, you know. And
I know.
We got talking, and we became tremendous friends. And the first time I noticed anything different about him was one Friday night at his house when his mother lit the candles. And I said, "What are these candles?" And he said, "Why, you know, we're Jewish, and Friday night you light the candles." Well, of course, I'd never met any Jewish people in Belfast. There weren't many living in the city in my day. And that was fine by me. Then the next thing that happened, I started having people coming up to me at school and saying, "Why are you going about with a Jewish boy?" And so one was straight into the same sort of rubbish that one had had in Belfast, where people, apparently, people's religions, and it's a race thing, of course. And it just was something that I simply couldn't accept at all. And I think it stays with me in an effect on my work to this day, because there's a thing about Jack Higgins' books which is very frequently commented on by people, both by fans who write to me and sometimes by interviewers. They say, one thing that is distinctive in your thrillers is that you take a very broad view of all the protagonists, even the enemy, so that you actually write about good Germans, even if they're fighting for the Nazis, or your KGB colonel may in fact be quite a human person, whereas sometimes the CIA man or the MI5 man may actually not be so good, but you take a very human look at people. And a lot of people come, they like this about the books. I think it gives the book a special flavour. And I think it's obvious that it goes back, the roots are in what happened to me in those years. The kind
and
of things that described
evidence you. The Night of the Fox, which you have as a hero, the Jewish man who portrays Rommel, who is a legitimate hero.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And, I mean, it's an interesting point, this, you know, that if you consider literature, whatever we mean by literature, quite often the literary establishment behave in quite a strange way. They will say, Chekhov or Tolstoy or Dickens or H.G. Wells or Arnold Bennett or Hemingway or Fitzgerald, you know, the great writers, and they will say, of course, a writer is very much a product of his roots and a product of the traumas of his life and all that kind of thing. They say this all the time, you see, and they do doctorates on it and write books about it and everything else. It never seems to occur to these people that exactly the same thing is true of a commercial best-selling author, that even though Jack Higgins, and I presume it's the same of everybody else, you know, Ludlum, Forsyth, Archer, all the big names, that it's rather like saying you are what you eat. You are what you write. What you are and attitudes and what's happened to you is bound to come through, even writing on the level of honest entertainment. But that, it's funny, the literary establishment, they seem to cut off at that point, and it never seems to occur to them that that's so.
Well, let's go back again. Your education, after primary school, after high school, what happened?
Well, I didn't go to high school properly. I mean, I cut out at 15 and worked at lots of very indifferent, poorly paid jobs.
Why did you do that?
Money, family circumstances, you know, it was too difficult to keep going. And what happened was I did some education at nights. And then we still had the conscription, the draft in Britain, because we had that until the 1960s. So everybody had to do minimum of 2 years, or they could keep you longer if they needed you, you know, special circumstances. And I got pulled into the army, and I was in an infantry regiment, then I was in a guards regiment, the Royal Horse Guards, not on the mounted section, because those are the guys who ride around London in the plumes and breastplates and things, you know, in the royal processions. But of course, the regiment's actually a fighting regiment, armoured cars and things like that. In fact, it had a squadron in the Falklands campaign. But we were, we operated mainly in Germany, on the East German border, on security duties, mainly in very remote areas. It was the sort of job where we'd live in some old camp, and then you'd maybe have 100, 150 miles of the border to patrol up and down. It was to do with trying to control illegal passage of people passing backwards and forwards between West and East Germany. And then we did some time in Berlin. So it was mainly that kind of thing. The interesting thing about that was I got to know a lot of Germans who'd served in World War II. The reason was, what with the kind of general rundown of British-American forces in those areas, we didn't really have enough men to do all these duties. So they recruited a lot of German personnel as a Not exactly as police. It was a specialised function, but it was a kind of police function. And they worked with us, you see, to control the areas. And, of course, naturally, they tended to look for ex-military personnel. And so one met some fascinating people, you know. I mean, you met guys who'd been lieutenant colonels at 25 on the Russian front and things like that, you know. And, of course, what you began to realise was that if, like me, you were a boy during the war, all you saw of Germans were wartime war pictures and thrillers where the Germans were always incredibly unshaven, evil, sticking bayonets in babies, or Gestapo men torturing women, or wearing black leather coats all the time and slouch hats, you know. And here one was meeting men a few years after the Second World War who were perfectly reasonable people, just like you and me, assuming that we're perfectly reasonable people. But you take my point. And one thought, yeah, you know, here are these people who obviously weren't Nazis and so on, but they were fighting for their country. Probably they didn't agree with it in the first place. But as we all know, because of later history since the Second World War, you often get caught in a situation like that, where your country's taking a move, like, say, Vietnam was an example. And the Falklands in Britain, you see, very, very large section of British society, feels that the whole Falklands thing was a mistake, that we should never have mounted a military operation. It's an arguable point, you see. And, all right, that was in a much smaller scale than Vietnam, but, you know.
I can see that this experience in the service began to lay the groundwork for a lot of your novels. In a way, that became your education then.
Sure. And when I think one of the worst aspects of it was that before I went into the service, I was working for the city in one of the city offices, the highways department, the department that looked after the roads and streets and construction work and so on. And I was just a young guy, young junior there, you know, doing various not very important tasks. And I went off, and this regiment I was in was a very elite regiment. The training was incredibly tough training. I mean, we've been reading about Prince Edward recently, but I mean, I was doing all that years ago, all that being dragged through the flooded tunnel and crawling through the mud and you know, all these very strenuous tasks and running with 70-pound packs on your back, etc. Guards, the Guards Brigade in the British Army has a great tradition of elite, as an elite, and they're very jealous of that. And I finally actually became an NCO. Now, for a conscript to become an NCO in a regiment like that was unusual, because usually the regulars got those promotions. And so I'd really proved myself rather well. And when I took my discharge and went back, I went back to the old job, because I couldn't think of anything else to do at the time. And I tried to get into college, but they wouldn't give me the kind of scholarship that you sometimes got if you'd been in the services. There was a reason, there's some technicality that I couldn't meet. And I went back to the old job. And the sad thing was that here I was, 2.5 years older, having done all these things, some quite dangerous and active things.
How old
things.
Were you at this point?
21. I'd actually, on occasions, we used to jokingly call the function we were performing on the East German border, we used to say it was World War 2.5, because it was the odd angry shot, you know. Occasionally there was shooting, occasionally somebody got wounded. I remember a friend of mine did get killed. But no, it wasn't normal war, it wasn't heavy casualty rates or anything, but it was dangerous enough on occasion. So in other words, one had experienced that. And also this business of becoming a non-com in a crack regiment and so on. And I was suddenly back at what I'd been doing before, and I was treated like a lad again. You know? Just like the boy in the office again. And that was a tremendous shake. I stuck it a few months, and then one day I simply couldn't take it anymore and did an unusual thing for me. I've never been a great drinker, but I went to the bar across the road and had a few beers at lunchtime, and having got myself in a nice state, went back and told one of the secretaries to type out my resignation, and I sneaked into the boss's office and put it on his desk so I couldn't get it back. And I left, and I had nothing to go to. And after a period of unemployment, I spent a period of some years, once I started working again, doing a whole range of funny jobs. I took a job as a tent hand with Bertram Mills Circus, which is a famous English touring circus.
A job is what?
Tent hand.
A tent hound?
A tent hand.
Oh, tent hand, yes.
Yeah, these guys put everything up, mm-hmm. The big top and the seating and all that kind of thing. Very rough guys and a very rough job. So that was educational as well. And I did that, and I was a burglary surveyor with an insurance company, which sounds very grand, but all I had to do was go around and check the locks and security for in this insurance firm when people wanted insurance on small businesses. I was what we call in England a traveller, a travelling man. You know, I'd go around small towns selling tobacco and cigarettes for a tobacco firm. Very poor tobacco and cigarettes, I might say, so it was a very difficult job. I did a host of things like that. And what I did in my spare time, I was trying to write without any success. Didn't sell a word. But what I did do, I completed high school education in the evenings, in my spare time. So that I found myself round about the age of 25, 26, having had this vast range of jobs and wasted a great deal of time. But I actually had college entrance and so on, you know, if I could go to college. And it was round about that time. I didn't have any ties. I wasn't married or anything like that. And I suddenly decided that I would go to college. And I had to go specifically on a teaching course, a school teacher's training program. And the reason I was able to go was that it happened to be a period in England when there was a heavy shortage of school teachers. As with America, it's not exactly the best paid profession in the world, you know. And the government introduced a training program in which if people were suitably qualified to go to college, you would be given a grant to pay your expenses. It wasn't a very good grant. I mean, it just barely kept you alive on the course. But it did mean you could do that. And I went to teaching college.
Where was that?
In Yorkshire. Yeah. Still in Yorkshire.
Name of the school?
Carnegie. And I went to this college, and I was so poor that, and I had so little money that, in fact, you weren't supposed to work. There were college rules, you see. They were very old-fashioned. It was a very old-fashioned place. And what I used to do, I used to had a little room on the campus, a little bedroom come study room, and I used to lock the door from the inside and climb out of the window at night, say 9 o'clock, and I'd go down to town, which was only, the centre of the city was only 15 minutes bus ride away. And I would go down to town, and I had a job on the night shift at the post office. I used to go around with the vans, you know, taking the mail sacks all over the city to all the sub-post offices and depots. And that job was supposed to run through till 6 o'clock in the morning, but we always had the work finished by 5 o'clock. And I would run out and run into City Square, where the early morning buses were starting up, and I'd just catch, there was a time, a certain bus, and I'd just catch it. I was usually the only passenger, and because at that time in the morning nobody wanted the bus would wouldn't stop, you know, it would be like it would rush through the streets, and we were up at the college in 10 minutes, and I would jump off, walk through the grounds with the birds starting to sing, and then the corner of the building had bricks sticking out, you know, almost like little steps, and I climbed up about 25 feet and in through my bedroom window, and then I would lie in the bed, go to sleep for 3 hours or something like that, and then a friend would come and wake me up for breakfast. And then during the day, in between my program, I would try and find time for another hour or two sleep. So that was a pretty strenuous time doing that.
Oh, I'll say it was. Did you, when you got out of college, did you go into teaching?
I did, yes. I taught in high school. I mainly taught older young people, 16, 17, 18-year-olds in high school.
English?
Oh, yes. Well, the particular school I was at, we had a lot of immigrants as well, because we had a catchment area, which this particular city, I was living in Leeds, has always had a very old history of taking immigrants in, of a place where immigrants came to, because there had been a great deal of Jewish immigration back in the end of the 19th century, 1880s, 90s, 1900 and so on, and it established a tradition of immigrants coming in. For instance, the Hungarian Rising, with lots and lots of Hungarians came to the city, you know, who fled from Hungary. Lots of people from the Caribbean, from Jamaica, Barbados, places like that, chose to come to the city when that sort of immigration started in the 50s and 60s. Quite a lot of Indians, and a lot of Indians, you know, who had the right to come to England, started moving in. So we'd quite a cosmopolitan crowd in the school, you know. During this time, I'd managed to get published at a very modest level. Just thrillers, crime stories, things like that.
Under the name of Patterson.
And then I varied it a bit.
Well, tell me about the first one that you sold. What was the name of that?
Well, it was a thriller called The Sad Wind from the Sea. And it was, why it has such a funny title, I'd written it some years before in my Hemingway period, and I saw it as a very serious sort of Hemingway-style novel. And it was no good, really, and it was in a bottom drawer, and I was looking for something to write during the vacation at college, and I found this in a bottom drawer, and when I read it through, I thought, it's very badly written, it's sort of mock Hemingway, you know. But it occurred to me that the story was really quite good, quite interesting. So, so what I did, I read the first chapter, then threw it away and sat at the typewriter and did it out of my head, then did the same thing with all the ensuing chapters of the book. Totally rewrote it out of my head after reading the chapter, you see, and getting the story in my head. Well, of course, I'd done a great deal of writing in between the first time I'd written that book, and I'd obviously changed a lot, and I'd become slicker, I suppose, and so on. Anyway, the way the book came out as a straight adventure story. And I sent it to this literary agent I'd been put in touch with, and they managed to get it published, very modestly indeed. So in hardcover. But that title, The Sad Wind from the Sea, had really been a slightly heavy title, which had been intended for the book as I didn't originally envisaged it. You understand what I mean? But no, it got published in hardcover, and it even got into paperback. But it didn't sell in America, for example. It didn't get published in America. And I was caught, really, because all my ideas of writing other kinds of things, serious types of things, changed because the publishers wanted me to do more like this. And they wanted a book every 12 months, and there wasn't much money in it. And I'd got married, you see. And In fact, it started a family. So I need teaching paying badly. I needed all the money I could make on the side. And what I started to do was to use all my spare time to write more of these books. Now, as a publisher would only publish one in a year, it meant that if I wrote two or three, because they weren't particularly long books, they were just, you know, average length thrillers. If I wrote two or three, the only way I could get them published was by going to a different publisher and using a different name, because they won't use the same name, because they're going to clash with each other and so on. And so this, it's so simple. People often say to me, why did you spend some years using all these different names? It's perfectly simple. It was a business reason. It was the only way you could get the stuff published.
So you used several names, right?
Oh, yeah, I used a range of names. I was Martin Fallon. I was Hugh Marlowe. Harry Patterson, of course. Now,
did Jack Higgins come about?
No, what happened with Jack Higgins was, I moved out of high school into college, and I was lecturing in social philosophy in college. Because what happened was, after the teaching program, during those few years that followed, I also enrolled as a student at London University, because they had a program which allowed you to do their degree, if you were sufficiently well qualified, to do one of their degrees as an external student. In other words, I didn't need to attend lectures, but I had to. It's a very difficult thing to do, because you have to take the same examinations as the internal students. So it's got a very high fail rate, that system. Anyway, I took a degree in sociology and social philosophy, and I succeeded, and I got it. And so, as I say, I then moved up into college work, and I was lecturing in social philosophy in a very large polytechnic. And what happened was, I wasn't particularly interested. I did my job. It was, by that time, working in a polytechnic in those days paid better than working in a university, because they were being developed on a government program as very important new colleges, and they had every facility, you know, millions being spent on them and so on. And so they tended to rather headhunt and go out into the marketplace and pay more money for staff to get good staff. So for a while there, it was better than being in university. So the money was good. But I wasn't interested in promotion and things like that. I was interested in my writing. Because by then, by being prolific, I was actually making a few thousand a year out of writing. Very nice. It was beginning to pay the mortgage and buy the extra car and pay for holidays. It was okay. I wasn't a best-selling author or anything, but it was okay. So I wasn't interested like my friends were. They wanted promotion. I wasn't bothered, because I was already making more money than I would get out of promotion. And as often happens in life, do you ever notice this? It's when you're not interested, when you're not bothering, that it starts happening. In other words, what happened to me, because I didn't want promotion and I didn't want success, I started getting promotion and success. And I made some quite rapid progress upwards in faculty terms. We don't have the same system as you have in America, but the kind of grade I hit was like, in your terms, being an assistant professor. And then I was offered something much bigger. Would have meant being head of a faculty and so on. And I realized it would mean giving up writing, because I really wouldn't have been able to have pursued such a job properly and found the time to write. And I thought, well, I'm not giving very much up, because I've not succeeded in becoming a very successful author, you know. I work hard for a relatively small return. And I was talking to an old schoolmaster I met one day, who taught me when I was a boy, and he was just retiring. And he said to me, I was talking about my problem to him, and he said to me, I don't usually read thrillers, but I only read yours because you wrote them and because you were a pupil of mine. And he said, I think what's wrong with you is what's wrong with most thriller writers. He said most thriller writers construct a plot, first of all in the head, then they make the characters act out the plot. And he said that's not real life. He said in real life the plot is how the characters act. In other words, how you behave is the plot in real life. And he said, I think that if you start doing that, you would write a much more substantial story because your characters would be stronger and all the rest of it. Anyway, I went away, and roughly speaking, I followed that advice. I wrote a book called East of Desolation, where I just took a reason, a raison d'etre, what Hitchcock used to call the MacGuffin, the reason for it all. I didn't really have a plot. I'd read a newspaper account of a plane that had been found on the Greenland ice cap, which had disappeared years before. So I used that in my book. The plane is found. All of a sudden, all sorts of people turn up wanting to visit the plane. Why should they be visiting the plane? And I thought, well, I'll make it very simple. There'll be emeralds on board or something like that. And then I just allowed it to grow out of how all these people behaved. And also, I did a lot of reverse casting. I mean, when I had the hero, who was the bush pilot, you know, instead of making him the usual tough, two-fisted guy, I gave him a background in which he'd been in the city in England in finance, and he was an alcoholic who'd gone through a program, and to try and pull his life up, you know, again. He'd given up the kind of job he'd had, and the only other thing he could do was fly, because when he was in the draft, he'd been a Navy pilot. And so he's taken to being a bush pilot with a float plane. But he's not a hero. In other words, when the weather gets bad, he's frightened to death trying to land in the field. You get the picture, all that kind of thing. And if there's trouble in the bar with the men off the whalers, he's trying to get out of the door. If this sounds jokey, it wasn't a comedy or anything. What I was doing was a kind of reverse casting with people.
You were giving your characters character.
Yeah, real character.
Is this the first Jack Higgins book?
Yes, because what happened was when the agent read it, she said straight away, this is five times better than anything you've done before. It's totally different. The result is we've got to start all over again. We're going to have to start fresh. New publisher, new identity, new everything. And where the Higgins thing came in was my mother was a Higgins, you see. So if I was going to have a pseudonym, I figured I might as well stick to a family one, you see. So that's where Jack Higgins was born.
So you can actually see a difference between the Harry Patterson books and
oh,
the
sure.
Books.
Yeah, tremendous difference. I mean, there better be. But very quickly after that, it proliferated, the success. I mean, the books immediately started doing much bigger things. American publication, hardcover in America, softcover, lots of translations, and it all built very quickly.
Your first big book in the United States was The Eagle Has Landed.
Oh, sure,
that
yeah.
That was the one that made Jack Higgins a name that almost everybody
yeah.
knows.
Yes, well, there was a book before that called The Savage Day, and that was the book which gave me the first big step forward in England. It was the one in which I had an English major infiltrating the IRA in Ulster. And in England, it wasn't an enormous bestseller, but it actually sold a lot of copies and got in at the bottom end of the best-selling lists on its own, without the publishers having had a special campaign or anything. And I worked through that, this Irish thing. It was published in America. It wasn't a particularly long book. It didn't do as well here. It did okay, but it didn't do as well here. Then I followed it. I sometimes write books in tandem, where the idea's still in my head, and then there's maybe something else I want to say. So, for example, I'd written a book about The Savage Day, about this man in Ulster, and then I thought, what's it going to be like if you're an IRA man who wakes up one morning and realizes you've shot 32 people, and then it's a waste of time? It's not going to get anybody anywhere. And so I wrote a second book called A Prayer for the Dying, in which such a man, we meet him in England, having fled from Ireland and fled from all that violence. And of course, what he finds is he can't escape from violence because it's become part of his nature, and he becomes involved with gangsters and this kind of thing, and a priest who he's nowhere else to go. It's interesting that 11 years later, after I wrote that, that's just been filmed with Mickey Rourke and Bob Hoskins and Alan Bates by Golden. But when I finish that, I then had this idea for The Eagle Has Landed. But by then, I'd actually become a full-time writer, because a strange thing had happened. One of the Higgins books had been filmed, a book called The Violent Enemy. It was just a small British movie. No big deal. And I happened to owe Macmillan, English Macmillan, the publishers, a book. And I'd written a couple of detective stories for them under the name of James Graham, which nobody ever remembers now. And I owed them a book on a contract. So I wrote this book called The Wrath of God, which was an adventure story set in Mexico in the 1920s. Very downbeat adventure story. Too downbeat for the general public, really. It was a bit of a medieval morality play. Very violent, but very moral. Very, you know, people questioning all the time. The funny thing was, MGM bought it, and they made a big movie with Robert Mitchum, which Ralph Nelson directed. And, of course, they paid me quite a lot of money. The book, in other words, didn't do all that well, but I got quite a sizable pot. Oh, enough to make one realize that if I related it to what I was being paid in college, I was safe for 5 years. If I just continued to live the ordinary sort of suburban life I was living with a family, you know, a professional sort of life, same house and all that kind of thing. So I figured it was a good time to maybe do it full time, and I did. And really, what very quickly it started to turn over, things started to happening in a much more substantial way. And of course, the really colossal thing was Eagle, because I had this idea for The Eagle Has Landed. I mean, I'd been told, we go back to those soldiering days in Germany, I had heard rumours of this sort of thing, that certainly the Germans had had some sort of a plot. Well, there'd been enough strange plots in the war, and people having doubles and all that kind of thing, for one not to be particularly surprised by such a suggestion. But I never found any proof that what actually happened in The Eagle Has Landed happened in real life. A lot of the ingredients of the book are very real. And at the stage I wrote that book, that a lot of that kind of stuff had never been written about by anyone else before, you see. But I went ahead and wrote the book. And as I say, by that stage, I was actually earning quite substantially from writing and living a very comfortable life indeed, you know. I mean, I had a car, my wife had a car, my children were at private school, we could afford 2 holidays a year, you know, all that kind of thing. I was earning a lot of money, a lot more than people realize, because you see, what was happening by then was a lot of my work was being translated as well, so that the whole snowball, even though one hadn't written a specific bestseller, the total amount that you were making from each book was really quite substantial. And of course, by that stage, I'd so many books on the shelves that things like translation rights and so on snowballed even more, so that the money was coming in from past work. And also, I was beginning to get into the media and the area of publicity and journalists and all that kind of thing. That there were the first signs of the whole stress and strain of success, the destructive side of it began then, because my wife, my first wife, didn't like that at all. As many people don't, you know. She hated the intrusion. It was against her nature. And the idea that, that people were actually poking their noses into your private life and business and all that kind of thing, she didn't like at all. Also, there's another thing. You see, there's a phony side to success and the way it's portrayed in the media, and we all get drawn into it. It isn't that one is sitting there lying or being deliberately phony. What I mean by it is, everything's got to be shorthanded. I mean, if you ask me something about my career or whatever, I can't give you 24 hours in a day, 60 minutes in an hour, and all the rest of it. It's just like writing a story or a report. We condense, we, you know. And on occasions, it's slightly different from how it really was. In the end, you can't quite remember how it really was. You know, I'm sure you appreciate the point I'm trying to make. And again, that was something she hated.
So the professional success did lead to a personal failure.
Oh, very much. And in fact, at such a stage that when I was writing The Eagle Has Landed, in many ways it was a kind of refuge from life problems. To bury myself in such a huge undertaking meant that I didn't have to think about lots of other, you know, personal problems in life and so on. And I set myself up to write that book in a very particular way. I took over a room in the house. I had a bed in the corner of the room. Instead of desks, I had two huge tables with notes laid out and so on, and notes all over the walls, research notes and things like that. And so I lived a very strange life. I would write at night, I would maybe sleep for 2 or 3 hours during the day, then I would write again, have something to eat, go for a run, come back, write some more, or lie down for a couple of hours then. And I lived a very mesmeric sort of strange existence for some months while I was doing it, until it was finished. I wasn't very encouraged by the fact that during the time I was doing it, none of the publishers who were involved had any faith in it whatsoever. It was such an unusual project that, as one publisher said, you know, you can't possibly expect the public to go for a book about a bunch of krauts trying to kidnap Winston Churchill. You don't have any heroes. These people are Nazis, for God's sake, he used to say. Of course, when they read the book, they realized they had a bestseller on their hands. What they didn't realize at that time, because in this business, nobody knows, you know. Nobody really knows. And what they didn't realize was they were going to have such a massive bestseller. They thought it would be a bestseller. Particularly the English publishers, funnily enough. The Americans were much more certain, but the English publishers, being innately more conservative, still weren't sure that the public would go for it. And the result was that it became a massive success in England and was always running out of copies. You know, the publishers still were so conservative that they just weren't doing reprints and having stock in hand. And if ever there was a book where the return factor didn't apply, they never got any returns. Every copy available was sold out like hot cakes. And then one of the big national newspapers, because of all the fuss about it, serialized it for 6 days, Monday through Saturday 1 week, the Daily Express. Well, of course, that the publicity value of that was incalculable, and people bought it even more. The result was that actually when the paperback firm brought it out, which they did very quickly, they sold pro rata far more copies than the hardcover people had been, because they realized by then that this was a book which everybody was going to read. You see, a book like that, that kind of really massive success, it's like a film which is going to succeed massively. The people who go to it have got to be people who've stopped going to the cinema, but they go out to see that film. That film. Or the people who buy the book are people who've really stopped reading, but that book they read because everybody's talking about it. And That's always the sign of a really massive success, when that sort of thing happens.
We've got to leap ahead here, because we're almost out of time. We have to bring us up to 1987 and Night of the Fox. You live on the island of Jersey, I believe, as you open Night of the Fox. There are references to the only Jersey I know is New Jersey. I got a little confused. I'd heard of Jersey, but there seems to be a mix of people there. There's Irish, there's English, there's French, there's Italian. Jersey's kind of an unusual place, and was it English? Was it French? I mean, so here was kind of an education. This is where you set Night of the Fox. But that's not unusual, because isn't Jersey where you live?
Yes, I've been living there for about 10 years now. The British Channel Islands are Jersey, Guernsey, Alderney, and then some very small ones. Jersey is an island with about 80,000 people. During the Second World War, there were about 40,000 people there. Now, what happened was quite simple. Those islands are part of Britain, but they're in the English Channel, and they're closer to France than they are to the English coast. The result was, when the Nazis occupied France, it was an untenable position. There was no way the British forces, after Dunkirk, could have held the Channel Islands against German attack. So to spare the inhabitants the effects of military action and invasion, the British government withdrew from the islands. The Germans invaded, after bombing the main port a couple of times, just to encourage everybody, you know. And they sort of bombed the port and ships and demolished a few hundred houses and killed 80 or 90 people and wounded a couple of hundred more, and then came in as gentle conquerors. I'm being ironic there, of course. They took over, they brought in the Gestapo, they did all the usual things. They, in fact, didn't behave all that badly, because they were still hoping to invade England at that time. And so the generally held opinion is that by policy they decided to be better as regards the treatment of people in Jersey than they had been of people in Poland and Czechoslovakia and so on, from a propaganda point of view. Plus the fact that all that stupid racist nonsense that the Nazis had, you know, the Superman thing and the Aryan race and all that business. Remember that the English were counted as being okay racially. So maybe this had some sort of crazy meaning for them as well. But anyway, they took the islands over and they held them for 5 years. During that time, they built massive fortifications. I mean, they built an underground hospital of tunnels under a hill, the like of which you wouldn't see anywhere else in the world. It's a museum now. It's the most extraordinary thing you've ever walked through. And it was all built with slave labor. Russians, Jews, Spanish communists, people like that. They didn't employ local people. Again, it was part of the propaganda thing, not to have these Jersey English working on projects like that. Generally, the way the war ran through, the supply position became very bad, food shortages, things like that, so that towards the end of the war, it was near starvation in the island, hardly any electricity or gas and that kind of thing, and conditions were very, very bad. In fact, most of the islanders' lives were only saved by the fact that at the end of 1944, the International Red Cross intervened, and they received German permission to send in a couple of ships loaded with Swiss Red Cross supplies. So it's a very strange time, because here were English people who were actually being controlled by the Nazis. And it's a tricky thing to write about, because I'm sure you appreciate, as everywhere where you had an occupation, you always got some people who behaved badly, who collaborated with the enemy or whatever. And obviously in Jersey, there were people like this as well. You know, you used to get things like the Gestapo would get anonymous letters from people, and these people would be informing on other people, saying, if you go to so-and-so's house, you'll find a radio there. That kind of thing. Because things like radios were banned, you see. but a few people held on to radios because they'd listen to the BBC News, and then they would spread that news to keep people's hope alive, you see, to let them know how the war was going. Also, you had a few Americans in the island because gradually at that stage, you see, most of the bombers on the European run from England would pass over the Channel Islands. Well, obviously, especially on the way back from targets in Europe where they'd been hit by anti-aircraft fire, planes often came down, as you know, and they'd either try and make the islands to crash land or else they'd parachute over the bay. And the result was that quite a few American aircrew ended up in the island. They had a small prison camp. No big deal, 50 or 60 people.
How did it happen that you moved to Jersey?
Well, I moved to Jersey for tax reasons, because although Jersey's part of England, its local government and affairs are handled by the Jersey Parliament, deputies and senators. And we have much more advantageous tax rates than you get in the English mainland. I mean, we have a 20% basic income tax, for example. We also don't have, we're duty free. We don't have the very high dutiable taxes which you get on things. For example, a pack of cigarettes in Jersey. A pack of cigarettes in Jersey is about a third of the price of a pack of cigarettes in London. Petrol, gasoline in Jersey is almost half the price of what it is in England.
Well, a small island like that, it's no wonder that these landmarks play a role in Night of the Fox. I understand you even use as a location your own home.
Well, it was used by the Germans in the war. It was a machine gun platoon up there, because it's not a particularly old house, a house built in the 1920s, but it's up on a bluff a few hundred feet high, which give it a very commanding view of the south side of the island for many miles on either side, and the whole sweep of the bay, and you can see the main port over on your left a couple of miles away. So from a strategic point of view, it was obviously a very desirable situation for coastal defense.
Well, I think our tape is going to run out. They go for about an hour, and we've been chatting for almost that long. Night of the Fox has all of the elements of a Jack Higgins thriller. Use some of the same elements than The Eagle Has Landed. There's a double, and it's a wonderful book. People who have been your fans of this country are certainly going to enjoy Night of the Fox. I appreciate that you spent this past hour with me, and you really have had a fascinating life, and to hear all these tales, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I want to thank you very much for spending this last hour with me.
Right, thank you. It's a pleasure.